Welcome to With All Due Respect, where we discuss the big topics with respect and grace. I'm Megan Powell-Dutoit and he's
Michael Jensen.
On this episode, we're going to look at the issue of mental health and faithfulness. Mental health has been part of the conversation during COVID. People have argued for and against various public health measures by referring to the mental health effects. There's been a widespread understanding that a viral pandemic will have mental health costs as well. Yet quite often we talk about it as it's those people out there who need looking after rather than ourselves. And moreover, within the church, there's been a tendency to give spiritual answers to mental health issues. People, for instance, spoke disparagingly about those who were fearful or anxious, saying they needed to have more faith. But rather than use people with mental illness as debating points, this episode, we want to delve instead into what it's like to be people of faith dealing with mental health issues, which is actually a lot of us. We get personal about how experience interacts with our theology and ministry, and then we talk to psychologist Sarah Hindle. And then finally, we're going to read together a recent novel by an Australian author, which centres on a protagonist with mental illness. And stay tuned for a special offer then.
Secret life of us, finding out what makes the other M tick. Well, you may be wondering what happened to For Argument's Sake, that favourite of our segments. Well, one problem with this issue is it gets depersonalised, and we talk about it as if this all happens to other people. We didn't want to make that mistake here, so we are going to talk about theological and ministry issues, but from a place that includes personal disclosure. Just as all of us have ups and downs with our physical health throughout life, we're going to acknowledge that we bring to this topic our own experiences of mental health or lack of it. Yeah. So that's kind of personal. That's putting it on the line. what are we going to say, Megan?
Well, I guess maybe to own up to some of the really significant experiences. So, I mean, I have been diagnosed with anxiety and depression. I've been suicidal at times, and I'm medicated and have been medicated for a long time for those things. So this is something that I live with. I mean, what about you?
Well, I'm in denial or I haven't had those experiences, but I have sought counselling at least twice, partly situational stress and feeling low and sort of experiences of anxiety and trying to work through things. So I have done that twice. That took a little bit of doing, I have to say, because I think for a long time I just thought, well, it's about toughening up and being resilient and I should just, you know, anything that happens, you should just get over. But going to seek help was actually an act of resilience, was actually important to achieve resilience, because you do that not by just finding inner strength, but actually by depending on others and reflecting.
Do you think that that feeling that you had, do you think that's a gendered thing, or do you think that's being in ministry or a combo? Like, what do you think was behind that?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a combo. I mean, men are notoriously bad at going to the doctor for almost anything. So that's a fact, and that means I think that's true of mental health issues too. So the male suicide rate is very high, particularly of men in midlife. So men in the mid-40s to mid-50s do it tough because I don't think they have many friends and I don't think they actually go and seek help a lot. Mm. I was going to say, oh, you asked about ministry as well.
Yes,
I think ministers too, we tend to be isolated. And again, we're supposed to be the people who are doing the emotional heavy lifting for other people. And so we're supposed to look pretty much like we've got it all together. I mean, what's going to happen to my church if I admit that I have a mental health issue? That's, you know, what will they think of me? How can I get in the pulpit? And all of those things go through people's heads, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Actually, last night I was speaking in a preaching class and one of the students asked, you know, what about times when it's really difficult to preach? And I said, well, I went through a stage where I was preaching regularly when I was suicidal. So, I mean, that was not easy. But, I mean, it was actually doable, oddly. And I think it probably brought, I don't know whether it was good preaching or not, but it certainly brought something different to my ministry and has since, I think. At the time, it probably made ministry harder. But I think since then, it's actually developed my ministry to be more effective, I think, in being able to empathize and reach out and understand what various people are going through. And I think it has to be approachable if people realize that you're not up there not knowing what they're going on about.
Yeah, although I guess the difficulty, maybe you can speak more in a more formed way here, but it is the sense of the way in which mental illness in particular affects your sense of self. So I think we have a very static view of what the self is. There's this kind of cast iron thing called Megan or Michael, but actually, and so then which is sort of meant to be normal. And then if there's a sort of diversion from that, we don't know who we are anymore. And that becomes difficult because being a Christian is naming a kind of identity, and then being a pastor is having a kind of role. Does that accurately describe, or does that resemble something of the experience?
I mean, it depends, because there's whole various, what we sort of lump under mental health or even one particular condition is so various in terms of at any one time how it's coming across. And certainly when you're in a really bad state, sense of self is very affected. But, I mean, you're not functioning necessarily very well at anything and you need to get help. I mean, but in general, I would say that when I'm dealing with it as a general rule, I'm still me. I'm not some sort of other person. I mean, I think sometimes there's this idea of the person with mental health issues as other, but often I think the person who's being diagnosed and is dealing with it, whether that's medication or other treatment or so on, is in some ways a more functional person than other people. They're someone who's actually really dealing with who they are and who they are in community and how they're functioning in the world. So I think actually you can have a more integrated sense of self in that case, that it actually helps you to not sort of coast. So
yeah, I find this with recovering alcoholics. Mm. Often they've got more insight into themselves than almost anyone. They're really kind of wise people.
Yeah, I've actually been really interested in how many Bible characters, when I think about some really well-known, we think of as the great leaders, the prophets and so on, how many of them seem to deal with major mental health issues? And, I mean, that's obviously there's no modern diagnosis in the Bible, but you think of Paul, Jeremiah, Elijah, David, Jesus even, there is really significant talking about the mental health issues. But it's not seen as something that means they're unable to be leaders, or even that they're not like other people. It just seems to be part of the normal human experience at certain periods of time.
Yeah, I mean, Elijah's intriguing because God says to him, it's 1 Kings 19, and God tends to him sort of body and soul and kind of says to him, you know, he's in fear for his life. It's awful what he's experienced. And God says, well, here's something to eat, you know, which is something, there's something right about that because we're psychosocial, somatic human beings, you know, we're kind of total. And so he says, you know, he looks after us as in body as well as in the soul. I mean, we've been reading Job in our Bible study group lately, and he really wants to die. You know, it's quite explicit there. In Psalm 88, we read, darkness is my only friend. There's also, you know, people throughout Christian history who've experienced, you know, great Christian leaders who've experienced this too. I think Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the great Baptist preacher of the 19th century in particular, and I was reading that he said, the mind can descend far lower than the body, for in it there are bottomless pits. The flesh can bear only a certain number of wounds and no more. The soul can bleed in 10,000 ways and die over and over again each hour.
Absolutely. If I had to choose between lack of physical health or lack of mental health, I'd go over physical, having experienced both. I mean, how responsible do you think we are for this? Like, one of the things I think that's really difficult in the church is hearing people say, don't be anxious.
Yes, as if by commanding it, you can stop it.
Yeah, now you're anxious about being anxious.
Yes, I know. I had this. Yeah, I know someone who actually pointed this out. You know, this actually made me more anxious. I had an anxiety condition. And I think the trouble is, of course, it's taking a comforting word and making it a command, which as legalists we always like to do. But I don't think that's the context in either Peter or in Paul or in Jesus when they talk about not being anxious. But in particular, we do bear some responsibility for ourselves. But it's as if it's like taking your medicine. If you're physically unwell, it's about knowing yourself as best you can and taking whatever responsibility you can to, and I think that's true, to be healthy, and I think that's true of mental health as well. I mean, would you say that? But
I think
you're not to blame for the illness.
It's various, isn't it? Because physical health is the same. There's some things that you've done that were entirely preventable, other things entirely out of your control, and then you've got to deal with what you served up, and it's the same as that, and you can only do what you're able to do. I mean, in the Bible, I think medicine is talked about almost entirely positively. So I definitely think that's one of the responsibilities that we have, is to be wise in how we seek to treat it and do the best we can with it. And that's one way of not being anxious, I suppose, is, yeah. But I mean, I think that the not being anxious, I think that's still, you know, you're a, not every, every moment of every day, you don't know what, whether it's the mental illness, just normal things happening to you, you're just having to exist as you are. And you need all sorts of answers to that. You need a multi-factor answer, and some of that's treatment, and some of that is being able to trust in God in the middle of all of that. And, you know, not feeling upset that you need more than one answer, but realizing that's what it is to be an embodied person.
And I think I would say also, I want to head to the cross here, because the words about Jesus bearing our griefs and infirmities that we read in Isaiah, that includes our despair and our pain and our agony.
Mm. So I think overall, Michael, we're just kind of saying this is what it is to be human. People in ministry are like this. And the Bible talks to that experience about being human, but it's not some sort of thing that's other people or about not having faith. This is what it is. This is how we live. In recognition that we as pastors are not experts on this issue at all, we're going to talk next to clinical psychologist Sarah Hindle, who's also a Christian, and then we're going to discuss the best-selling novel Sorrow and Bliss by Australian author Meg Mason.
Speaking of mental health, things have been pretty tough over in Ethiopia, where Anglican Aid are doing a great project. The project's called Heading North, and it's a holistic community-wide project that they're trying to get there to help the communities rebuild, and especially because there's been some really tough times, not only COVID, but they've had conflict and other things too. What else have you heard, Megan?
Yeah, I mean, mental health, it happens in a context, and the context, of course, is affecting everything at the moment around the world, and in somewhere like Ethiopia is COVID. And there's some big, really heartbreaking stories that Anglican Aid have been heard and responding to. Like, for instance, a woman whose husband died as a result of infection because they couldn't afford the treatment. You might go to the house and discover the only thing they've got is water. They don't have any food. They've had a woman turn up with a disabled child. They haven't eaten for days. The only reason she came was because the neighbours wanted the child to stop crying. An old woman whose sons, she had abundant offerings as priests, but they've taken her land and given nothing to her, and so she's starving. So really, particularly women, as always, and children, as always happens, are doing particularly badly at the moment. So Anglican Aid are trying to meet some of those right, urgent needs in the middle of COVID, and that's one way that you can be helping, is by going there.
Yeah, you can be involved and you can help them on anglicanaid.org.au. So if you just go there, look for Heading North, and chip in, help them, make a donation. A little bit goes a long way.
Be our guest, opening up the conversation to others. In this episode, we've got Sarah Hindle with us, who's a clinical psychologist at the Centre for Effective Living in Sydney. She works clinically with adolescents and adults with issues related to mood, burnout, adjustment, trauma, obsessive compulsive and stressor-related disorders. She has a particular interest in supporting individuals with late diagnosis of neurodevelopmental conditions, as well as parents of children with ADHD and specific learning disorders. She's the wife of an Anglican minister and a Christian herself. Welcome to With All Due Respect, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me for this important conversation.
Well, it's really great to have you along, Sarah. And look, I wondered if we could start by talking about mental health more generally and about the language we use. Because, the definition of mental illness, for instance, changes decade by decade. Every time the DSM comes out, that Bible of mental health in the United States. And so it's very difficult to kind of get a handle on what is the right language to use. So could you help us here?
Yeah, it's such a great question, actually, because language, as we know, is defining. It's so important that we speak accurately and respectfully. I think I'd like to point out that mental health is a term commonly used when people aren't sure what's going on, maybe to refer to a non-specific psychological issue. But mental health is actually something we all have. Mm. It's something that makes us human. Mm. It's also non-binary. It's not the opposite of mental illness. So it's not at opposite ends of a continuum. Mental health can also fluctuate. So it's more helpful, I think, to think of mental health and mental illness as distinct states that actually can work concurrently. So we could actually have good mental health but also live with a diagnosed disorder such as depression or anxiety. And conversely, we could have really poor mental health but not experience mental illness. Mm. Also, I guess with regards to language, there are a few really sort of important elements to keep in mind as we're talking about mental illness. Usually it's better to be person first. So, for example, a person suffering from depression, unless a particular community has asked otherwise, which actually is the case in the autistic community, who like to be identified as autistic individuals rather than a person with autism. It's really important that we pay attention to what people with lived experience say, how they describe their experience rather than how a classification system describes an experience.
So is illness the right language? Not always.
Well, contentious. I would argue that we actually need to be sensitive to context. So, for example, if I'm sitting with a young person who struggles with, say, depression, I would be talking more about a difficulty, whereas if I wrote a report, I would use correct terms and call it a disorder.
And that's interesting about context, because there is this tendency to just lump all of the mental health issues in together, but there is diversity, isn't there? So how can we think about them in their diversity?
Oh, I think, Megan, that's I'm going to say a big yes to that. We do actually need to be able to have some mental health literacy and pass out some of these differences. It's really important for ourselves, for our own well-being, for picking up difficulties in those around us, that we're sort of able to identify where the difficulty sits. And I think a framework to help us identify this with some basic mental health literacy will help identify symptoms, severity levels, and whether, in fact, what we're witnessing in a friend or a partner is at a clinical level or not. Mm. So it really does kind of unfold a certain helpful pathway if we've got some basic literacy.
Now, moving into the church, why do spiritual and mental health issues intersect so deeply?
I think for all of us, values are really important to live out. The way I see mental illness interacting with values is often like a functional limiting of our ability to live the way that we want to live or to see ourselves the way that we want to see ourselves. And I think that at that point, the risk for Christians is that mental illness can become overly spiritualized. So it's quite common for me to be having conversations with a depressed person who's very preoccupied with their unworthiness, their sinfulness, or an anxious person who's really struggling with, am I anxious and unwell or am I ungodly? I just can't get it right. So Yeah, I think Christians are used to really reflecting on spiritual issues and theology and how we live out our faith. And we can actually be really self-deprecating bunch. That's something else that I notice in this community. Working with Christians, often if they fill out, say, personality testing and I'm interpreting results, I'll have to really pay attention to that because Christians will over-report. They'll be almost too honest, which inflates some scores. It's so interesting. Yeah.
That's fascinating that sort of shows a genuine wanting to do well and to do better, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think if we were to even go a level deeper underneath values, what we'd find is a whole attachment system that underpins the way that we see ourselves in relationship with God and God's people. Mm. So, you know, thinking about our own attachment system, if we have developed one in the presence of a really attuned caregiving system, we will grow up, having well-attuned processes that will allow us to experience goodwill in relationships and feel meaningfully connected. But if we don't have that experience, we may, you know, say we grow up in households where a parent might be harsh or rejecting or critical. There's an experience of deprivation of nurture. That might be where we first learn to kind of detach or to self-soothe, the beginning of what can become unhealthy coping modes later in life. So there is a real interaction between our attachment system and our relationship with God. It's really, really deep stuff.
Yeah. Well, what's some of the bad things that pastors and churches do for people coping with mental health issues?
Yes, and as you answer this question, I'll tick off the mistakes I've made, unfortunately.
Michael, I'm the last person to say try harder or do better. I actually think that ministers, pastors have such a huge role. It's just enormous. So, but I do believe that in terms of the training that they receive, the resourcing, perhaps more support, more resourcing, more supervision, because the reality is 1 in 2 Australians will experience mental illness in their lifetimes. That's half of our congregation at any given time. But I think, you know, perhaps one of the biggest issues, at least I can only speak from my denomination, is maybe the lack of acknowledgement of mental illness. It's just not mentioned, or if it's mentioned, it's in passing. And what does that communicate about the acceptability of being a person who struggles? I think mental illness needs to come out from a purely pastoral care domain and into the mainstreams of our church communities. If we want our communities to be welcoming, to be safe, to be free from stigma, we need to hear from Christians with lived experience of mental illness. We need to be asking them, what is it like to be at church? What would make it easier to engage? And I suspect also too, having key people in each church who have training and can advise would also be a wonderful resource for our congregations.
It's so hard because the often where mental health gets us, where mental illness gets us, is in the relational part of our world. Yeah. I mean, just as with our relationship with God, it sort of impacts relationships. It isolates, or it scares people in different ways, which make connection very difficult. And I think the community on the whole, has very little patience for that. We want to be with functioning people. The church has a different calling, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's just like it's the saddest thing for any human to be without real engagement or just superficial relationships. Actually, one of the biggest known buffers for any mental illness is social connection. So, you know, people who are desperately lonely will start to really improve and their loneliness will decrease when they get in contact with others. And I don't even mean meaningful relationships, like close friendships. It can be the coffee guy, the person at the library, the checkout chick, that will actually start to turn things around. And I think also on your point, Michael, about connection, barriers to connection, not knowing how to establish connection. This is something that's very much focused on in my profession. So we're all trained to really attend to the therapeutic alliance, the rapport that we develop with a client. It is so incredibly important. It's like a vehicle for change. And some, you know, studies have indicated that it can actually account for up to 40% of positive outcomes from therapy, just the relationship. Doesn't matter what intervention you use at that point. So I guess what I would really love to see in our churches is that we feel okay feeling uncomfortable, that we're okay to sit with a bit of distress, that we don't feel like we have to solve or fix or do. We can actually just be. Because that's a really, really healthy place to be.
What's, you know, Job's comforters were doing so well until they opened their mouths. They kind of sat with Job in his suffering, and that was fantastic. Then they tried to fix it.
And I think we respond to our own discomfort with sitting with distress. That can be our own issues of avoidance and detachment. And perhaps a bit of self-reflection at that point. What's the interfering factor here? What's the barrier for me to be able to sit quietly and listen and be that person for this person in front of me right now?
So interesting what you're saying about we put it in the pastoral care basket because Michael actually pointed out to me an article that's just come out which was saying that the rates of mental health or well-being are quite good in churches, but perhaps that's because churches are places where people who are having any kind of struggle in that way feel unable to access the church. They're just not going. And so that's actually a problem more than a good thing. And someone posted this actually in our Facebook group just yesterday, coincidentally, and I saw a lot of people talking about how worship itself, the way that we do worship, is very sort of facile and requires people to have a certain very narrow emotional range.
It's peppy. The last thing a depressed person wants is peppy.
So I'm wondering whether that's part of it too. Do you think that having up front, more emotional range up front, that or that ability to allow diversity of emotional experience up front would help?
Oh, absolutely. Look, again, I'm speaking from a particular denomination, but I've grown up sitting in churches where everything is an paralysis by analysis. It's overly intellectualizing. It's sitting in our head. There's no integration of whole being. It's not holistic. And I think what does that model that we need to subjugate our emotions, that they're not acceptable, that we have to cram our worship with theology, that we can't express ourselves freely, that there's no place for that. So, yeah, absolutely, there's scope for more and more emotional diversity. I'd like to see, you know, consideration of disabilities as well as mental illness in our church spaces, because I think you're right, Megan, it's profoundly sad, but I wonder if we even have true diversity that matches the rest of the population within our congregations.
So what about ministry workers? So, you know, self-interest, of course, this is the self-interested question, but ministry workers with mental health issues, I mean, you said one in two. I mean, of course, as ministry workers are going to have to watch for their congregations and develop mental health literacy, but what about themselves?
Yeah. Look, I get concerned about ministry workers sometimes. I think there's some particular vulnerabilities that we see. One of them's around work, hours worked. Quite a susceptible bunch for things like burnout and mood disorders because they work really, really hard. There's a high degree of responsibility. They're often high achievers. There's something about the cutoff of about 50 hours worked in a week that is quite highly predictive of burnout. And we also know from national church life survey data that senior ministers and solo ministers are also a very vulnerable group. There's a sense in which if we are, you know, if our ministers really over-identify with their role, if there's role fusion, such that they themselves are not successful if the church is not successful, if the church doesn't grow, they are a failure. That's another red flag. Also, I think that our ministry workers need resourcing. They're often having to operate in areas outside of their competency. And this is what I was saying earlier about it being such a huge job. So this is not kind of like do more, try harder, but it's go to appropriate resources, help yourself, limit work hours, make sure there's adequate rest. Something else that's really worth attending to is unhelpful personality features. So we know that ministry workers, actually psychologists as well, can often be really high on self-sacrifice, really high on unrelenting standards, really high on self-subjugation or emotional inhibition. So these sorts of personality markers will lead us to work and work and work to the bone and prioritize the needs of others and neglect our own core needs. So we actually need to be sending our ministers on holidays, recommending that they have some sort of coaching or supervision ongoing, not once every 6 months. They need more resourcing than that. They deserve more than that. And also sending them to therapy when they need it. It's healthy.
Yeah, I know Megan can speak from the Baptist perspective, but I know in our Anglican denomination, we've actually allowed people to have 10 free psychological, some counselling visits, which has been really, I access that myself. Because one of the things is price. You think, I can't afford that or can't justify that. And that seems indulgent, but actually allowing you and being encouraged by the bishop to do that under stress was a really very helpful, and also by my wardens, I've got to say, it was a really great thing. You know, that's a different, I think that's been a change in the last 10 to 20 years when we've realized the cost of clergy burnout, what it costs everybody.
Yeah. Oh, we've been working on it too. Yeah. And I'm just hearing what you said there, I felt like you'd turned the microscope on myself. Certainly I left pastoral ministry partly to avoid burnout that I saw was about to happen. So I'm into all of that. We're just coming to the end of our time that we have available. Could have talked to you for a lot longer, but what are some last things you'd like to say, perhaps of where to go next if people want to look into this more, develop some of that literacy that you were talking about or just seek help?
Yeah, I think, look, if there are issues, I just can't stress enough how valuable it is to sit with a therapist who'll look at your lifespan, your developmental history, who'll pull some of these threads together to look at how you've adapted, how you've coped, how you've got along in life, to what extent that coping may get in the way of flourishing. And for some Christians too, just to give you permission to attend to your own needs, to validate that is incredibly important. So this sort of alliance is incredibly powerful. I think if we are really just focusing on symptom management and band-aid solutions, that may not be enough. But someone that will sit with you, go a little bit deeper, is a catalyst for real long-lasting change. The underlying mechanisms that perpetuate the symptoms, that's where we want to go for long-lasting change.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Sarah. It's been really informative and stimulating, and I hope the conversations actually go further on this particular topic.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, still to come, fictionalized accounts of mental illness have often contributed to stigma and misunderstanding. In Meg Mason's acclaimed 2020 novel, Sorrow and Bliss, the narrator has an unspecified mental illness. We take a look, and we also have a special offer to tell you about.
In the new year, there's going to be a new podcast joining the network, Michael, called Run Like a Woman.
Run Like a Woman? But isn't it supposed to be Run Like a Girl? What's it about?
It's about women. There you go. Shines a light on the experiences of ordinary Aussie Christian women. And it's got some women that we know involved. So our former producer, who's wonderful, senior journalist at Eternity, Rebecca Abbott, is going to be one of the hosts.
And Penny Mulvey as well, who's an experienced radio journalist and chief communications officer at the Bible Society Australia.
Yes.
And, of course, our former producer, Bella Ann Sanchez, is chipping in as well. Is that right?
Yeah, our editor, she's going to be editing and co-producing this. So some fantastic people that'll be great for people to know better will be heading this podcast.
And they've got great interviews on it. Like, who have they got on it?
Well, Justine Toe, a friend of our podcast, indeed.
Yeah, I know her.
Yeah. Naomi Reid, who's got some fantastic stories that she has enabled to come to the fore, and Susanna McFarlane. So
great.
Some really good people there. So I think it's going to be very encouraging for women to hear from other women and for men to hear from those women as well. I think that'll be great.
And so when's it starting again?
The new year.
The new year. So in January, tune in to eternitypodcast.com and pick up Run Like a Woman. Mark and Dave, two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. Now, Meg Mason is a Kiwi-born, Sydney-based author who caused a sensation last year with her second novel. It was set in England, called Sorrow and Bliss. And in the novel, a 40-year-old woman, Martha, tells the story of about 20 years of her life. It's a story of depression and undiagnosed mental illness and of her troubled marriage. It sounds bleak, yet it's also hilariously funny. As the review in The Scotsman said, if this sounds depressing, it really isn't. Compulsively readable, Sorrow and Bliss is one of the funniest books I've read, in part because Martha turns the biting humour that is at once her survival mechanism and downfall on herself and everyone she meets. Let's give you a taste of that bite.
In the car on the way home from the last party Patrick and I went to, I said, "When you do that pointing thing, it makes me want to shoot you with an actual gun." My voice was dry and mean, and I hated it. And Patrick, when he said, "Great, thanks," with no emotion at all. I don't mean in the face, more like a warning shot in the knee, or somewhere that you could still go to work. He said, "Good to know," and put our address into Google Maps.
Well, Megan, did you like Martha?
God, I loved the book. I think this might have been the best book I've read all year, and I devoured it. I gulped it down in one evening, I think.
So better than my book on Anglican worship.
I haven't read that yet, Michael. I'm saving that up as a special treat. Martha, you know, people actually said that they thought that the that she was unlikable as a character, but I didn't find that. I think she's just, because she's narrating it, it's her view on herself. So I don't know if she's the most reliable when it comes to herself in that sense, although obviously you get this wonderful interior of what it's like to be her. But interesting, because I think as you get to the end of the book, you start to get a different view on almost every character when you realise that your view of her and all the other characters has been through the prism of her mental illness that she hasn't understood and that other people haven't understood.
Now, I haven't got to the end, which is just as well because I'm getting in trouble for giving away spoilers, so I can't give away a spoiler this time. I really enjoyed reading it. I'm looking forward to finishing it and particularly to seeing how she resolves these kind of tensions that are right in the tension between her sort of numb experience of life because of her illness and yet the cracking good humour that's in there too, which is really delightful and makes it possible to read a book about such a bleak topic. But what about the fact we don't know what the illness is? I read a few reviews, particularly for sort of reader reviews, who said they really hate it that they didn't know what the illness was.
Yeah, I think I'm in two minds. In one sense, by not saying the illness, even at the end, I mean, I'm going to stand all the way through it because, of course, that's her experience. She doesn't know what it is. But even at the end, not say it, I think actually means that we can put a whole lot of different experiences onto her experience. It doesn't become kind of sort of just put into a nice, neat box. And so that's good. On the other hand, perhaps if it had been named, It might have given more understanding of, because I think there probably is a particular disorder that's being talked about here. So it would have given more understanding that way. So I'm not sure. But it's the author's artistic choice, and so I'm going to honour that.
Yeah, I love that you didn't name it, because it kind of then comes out as your sort of, you know, bipolar novel or something like that. You know, it narrows it down and takes the focus off the actual experience by giving it a label. And I think by bringing us into and humanising the interior world of this experience, it makes it a much more interesting fictional journey and gives us much more chance for empathy. And it just sounds less pretentious and worthy, I think, in the way it goes along. Now, why has it been so acclaimed? Do you think it's justifiably acclaimed?
Look, that you could write something like this, which is a major interior journey into her experience of mental illness, but also it's a family drama and all the problems with the family, to take something like that and yet to make it so compulsive, to make it so funny. This is unbelievably amazing what she's done, I think, and really intriguing. I read an article about how this came about, and she'd had one novel already, and she'd been contracted to write another one, and then she'd kind of thought, well, she'd been trying to write something else and she hadn't got there, had massive writer's block. And eventually sort of gave up and she thought, that's it. I'm not going to be sellable. I'm not going to have a career in this. So I just might as well write what I want to write. And she just wrote without any of those kind of constrictions about what's going to be saleable or anything like that, or whether even the publisher would take it. And what you got was amazing.
Now we have a special offer that we should tell our listeners about. And, it's this book and also The Way I See It by Lucy Marrott, which gives an inside look into the experience of anxiety. Mm. So, you know, a similar kind of theme with a totally different experience.
And another Australian author. Yep.
Yeah, another Australian author. And what's the deal?
So this was a birthday offer, because we've reached 3 years of the podcast with Little Lost Bookshop. And if you use the code WADR, WADR in caps, you can get 20% off either of those books at the moment, which is fantastic. So go take advantage of that, and thank you all the people at Little Lost Bookshop. And a link to that website for the bookshop will be in the show notes. Thanks for being part of With All Due Respect. Coming up next episode, it's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas. Or is it? Is the experience of Christmas something like homecoming or exile?
And as we ponder Christmas with COVID, we take a look again at the story of Christ and how that informs the stories we tell at Christmas time. So we're really looking forward to seeing you then.
See you then. With All Due Respect is hosted by myself, Megan Powell-Dutoit, and Michael Jensen. It's produced by Mark Hadley, and the editing is done by Nicholas Van Soest. With All Due Respect is part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Head to eternitypodcast.com, where you'll find show notes and lots of other things related to our episodes, and click on to our Facebook group to join in the debates. With All Due Respect.
The Eternity Podcast Network. eternitypodcasts.com.au